Depending upon your vantage point, what you see and what I see may be very different. A football referee may signal fumble, something that Sue and I listened to Notre Dame do a lot of last night as we were driving home. But another ref from another angle may see something very different, and they said the ball is down by contact. The planet would seem like an enormous place if we were to walk around the Earth nonstop. You know how long that would take, depending upon your gait? About 2 years, 11 months, give or take a week or two. And that's enormous. Unless you're talking about taking a stroll on the largest known body in the universe, which is a star called Canis Majoris. To walk around that body would take you 650,000 years. Size, you see, is a matter of perspective. When we were young, time crawled. Time just couldn't go fast enough until we got to be 13, and then we got to be 16 and got a driver's license, and then graduation couldn't come fast enough so that we could be out from under mom and dad's roof to call our own shots and to be our own bosses. But then something odd happens. At some point in life, time no longer crawls, but it starts to speed up. You're changing your daughter's diaper, and the next thing you know, you're dancing with her at her wedding. One day it hits you like a ton of bricks that you do not have enough time to accomplish all of the goals that you set for yourself. There comes a day when you realize that you're going to doctors' offices and funerals more often than you used to. Because whether time flies or time stands still is all a matter of perspective. A college student emailed her parents and said, "Sorry it's been so long since you've heard from me, but it's been very hectic around here. There was a fire in my dorm room, and trying to escape, I fell from a second-story window and received a concussion. I didn't want to let you know because I knew you would worry, but my vision is clearing up. It's not as blurred as it once was. I met a wonderful man I'd like you to meet. He was driving by the dorm on his Harley, and he saw me fall out of the window. And after I got out of the hospital, he asked me if I would move in with him to take care of him. I know you're going to like him. He's got the coolest tattoos. His name is Boomer. You'll also be pleased to know that you will be grandparents in 7 months. You'll get to meet Boomer at Thanksgiving." Now, just to let you know, Mom and Dad, please don't worry, because there was no fire, no concussion, there is no Boomer, and there will be no grandchild, at least no time soon. I just wanted you to know that I got a D in chemistry and an F in calculus, and I wanted you to keep things in perspective. Perspective is everything, isn't it? Because what you see and I see can be very different. And when it comes to interpreting this parable of Jesus, this parable of the talents, we need perspective in order to do it. And one of the first things we must do is acknowledge a biased perspective. Because I would venture to guess that many, if not most of you, feel sorry for the guy with one talent. Our sense of fairness is violated. We think he was treated absolutely horribly. because we're always rooting for the little guy. We love it when the little man sticks it to Mr. Big. We are definitely on the side of the third servant. But you can't do it quite like that. But I think for starters, you know, we identify with the little guy because, like him, we are responsible people. We work hard to earn money, and we save it, and we invest it, and we roll it over, and we sometimes give it. And you have to remember that when Jesus told this parable, there was no entity called the FDIC. And the way to keep large sums of money secure back in those days was to bury it. You're not home, don't answer. You buried that money. So that way you could be sure to get it back safe and sound. But rather than praise the servant's caution and his desire not to screw it up, the master chewed the poor guy up one side and down the other. He called him lazy and stupid. He called him a wicked weasel. And he ordered him thrown out into the dark to sob until his eyes ran dry and to grind his teeth to the gums. Now, we don't like the treatment that this little guy received. But you see, when we look at the parable through the eyes of the other two servants, we see something very different. Because they understood what the one talent guy did not. They acted upon what the servant had given them in a way that the one talent guy would not. They understood who the master really was, while the little guy with the little talent totally misread him. Now, the word talent comes to us from the Greek word talanta. And the word talent in this context has nothing to do with having a lovely voice or having artistic creativity or being able to whistle Dixie. A talent was a huge sum of money. It was the largest denomination of money in Jesus' day. That servant who was given five talents was given the same amount as 15 years of wages. And that was huge. Even one talent of silver was about 75 pounds of silver. And so servant three decided that hiding his talent was the prudent thing to do. After all, it's good to keep possessions safe than it is to risk losing them. And so upon the master's return, Mr. One Talent strolls in the office and said, "Welcome back, boss. You know, the other servants and I were talking that you really know your business. You're shrewd. You're always looking for ways to turn a profit. You drive hard bargains. You won't take no for an answer. You're the only guy I know who can squeeze blood out of a turnip." And what, the master said. "Well, and I was afraid of you. And that's why I buried the town. I've always been afraid of you. So I took what you gave me. I buried it in my backyard. Here you are, sir, every cent of it, just as you gave me." But it was a very different story for servants one and two. They managed to double the investment the master had given them. They weren't afraid of the master. They weren't intimidated by him. They knew that to invest something required risk. They had what the little guy did not, and that was nerve. And they meticulously studied the stock and bond indices. They diversified, and they wheeled, and they dealed, and they doubled the master's money. And now the master, when he received servants one and two, smiled at them and said, "Well done, good and faithful servants." And so they handed over this huge sum of money to them, and he pushed it back. He said, "Keep it." He said, "Beg your pardon?" He said, "Keep it." "Oh, what do you mean, keep it? Keep it. You mean keep the interest?" "No, keep the interest and the principal." Now, who does something like this? To say it's all yours. And which servant really knew the master? From servant three's perspective, the master was hard-nosed and miserly, a person to be feared, and he couldn't have been more wrong. Because what kind of a master in his right mind would literally turn over all of his assets to his servants? Just give it all away and leave and say, "See what you can do with it, boys." Would a tightwad tell them to keep it? Would a tightwad say, "Keep the money plus the profit"? You know, servants one and two knew that their master was an extravagant master. And we have to look now at how the context in which Jesus told this parable. He told it as he was going to Jerusalem. He knew that the end of his earthly life was in sight, and so I believe he had to tell this parable with a sense of urgency, because God's mission and their very lives depended upon it. He said, "I'm going to be leaving you soon. I'm going far away, and I don't know when I'm coming back. So here you go, boys and girls. I'm giving you everything I've got, and I want you to wheel and deal with it." Now, imagine the Secretary of the Treasury going before Congress and saying, "I need $700 billion, with no explanation. Do you have an idea of how much money $700 billion is? If you were to count out dollar bills, one per second, do you have any idea how long it would take you to reach $700 billion? It would take you more than a lifetime. It would take you more than several lifetimes. It would take you 21,000 years. I want you to think about that. 1,000 years worth of counting. We gave more than that to wage wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. With 21,000 years worth of money, the experts say we could educate every person on the planet. With 21 years worth of money, we could feed every hungry person in the world and bring an end to poverty as we know it. We could do that if we wanted to. $700 billion. Now, let's say he's not going to request this for the Pentagon, and he's not going to give it to bail out Wall Street, but let's say he's going to give it to Jack and Judy Steckley. Now, they're going to have a chore on their hands when it comes to spending that amount of money. And once it becomes public that they have that money, there will be a line at their door circling the planet. People ready to befriend them and advise them and announce themselves as a long-lost relative. You can't possibly do anything with all. You can't spend all that money. You can't even think about spending all of that money. And yet we are given something even more extravagant than that. We are given the good news of the gospel. Let me suggest that what is really being talked about here is not just money, but it's the gospel. Life, new life, abundant life, full measure, pressed down, shaken together, overflowing life. And what do we do with the gospel? Well, we're not sure what to do with something that great, and so we'll turn it into church work. We turn it into keeping minutes at the next committee meeting. Or we'll turn it into brewing coffee for fellowship time, or checking for typos in the bulletin, for organizing education, fixing toilets, giving to outreach, paying the bills, tackling the deficit, asking the congregation to think big, but really not meaning that, because with our actions, what we really say is we're only expecting that which is reasonable. We take what we get and we operate accordingly, hoping to have an extra dollar or two at the end of the year. And here we are, given this extravagant good news of the gospel, the best news that most of the world has never heard, and we treat it like yesterday's news and glorify the past and bemoan how insufficient our resources are. James Howell is a United Methodist pastor, and he said that maybe what God needs most of all is people who will huddle up, shake their heads, and confess, we have no idea what to do with the treasure. We have no idea what to do with it because it's just too heavy. And I was thinking about this. I think it would be a good idea to change the name of this church from the Lincolnshire Church of the Brethren to the Community of the Clueless. Because we don't have an idea. Our mission statement would have to be changed. It would say something to the effect that the gospel is just too expansive, it's too explosive, it's way beyond our ability to manage. And perhaps in that process, we would learn that you need more than knowledge of how to, and you need more than smarts, and the gospel transforms lives not solely based upon what we do, but what God does through us. You know what happens when the gospel is managed? It's not the gospel anymore. Every time we say that sharing the good news and growing the church is a need admirably suited for another person, or for six out of our whole congregation who have stepped forward to say, yes, I'm going to engage with a person that I may not know very well, and I'm going to try to establish a relationship with them for the sake of the gospel. Every time we do that, we throw a shovel of dirt over the talent. Every time somebody is willing to take on some new responsibility and we nitpick because they're not doing it the way they're supposed to do it, then we throw in another shovel full. Every time we respond to challenges with, we can't do this, we can't pay for that, we drop in another shovel full. Every time we give reasons for not being able to help the poor and the hungry, there goes another shovelful. Every time we agree that tithing is scriptural, but say it's not practical given current circumstances, the hole fills up a little bit more. Every time we balk at doing something bold that can't be done with God, we end up where we always end up, right back at the same dog-eared excuses that ask no risk from anyone. And the hole is covered, and it's raked, and it is seeded. And it's not a talent that is buried. It's the church. My old friend Kermit shared an insight with me that he learned from being an Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years. He said, gratitude isn't a word. Gratitude isn't saying thank you for some generosity you have received. Gratitude isn't an outlook. It isn't an attitude. Gratitude is not a state of mind. Gratitude is demonstrated through concrete acts of loving service done in the name of the one who gave his all upon the cross. The Master is going to return. We know that much. He told us so. He didn't say when he's going to return, but return he will. And when he does, what are we going to say that we've done with what has been entrusted to us? Of our earthly treasures, of the gospel for which Jesus gave with extravagance. You see, when you don't have anything to lose, you can live and you can give with abandon, knowing that nothing you do is for the Master is ever lost. And when you have nothing to lose, then you realize that you have everything to gain. I hope you're not hearing this as a theological, biblical treatise, because what it comes down to is something very, very practical. Something we do every year at this time when you receive a nice letter from the pastor with a yellow card inside that asks you to indicate what you are going to do to support the ministries of the church for the coming year. It's so very easy to treat that as a transaction. Church gives to me, and so in gratitude, I'll give to the church. Or we treat it as a calculation. How much did we give last year? Let's up it 2% this year. That will be fine, but that's not what it's all about. Because what we are dealing with here is a God and a Savior who are so extravagant. And there's tension that happens at the point of God's extravagance and our philosophy of insufficiency. But folks, we are not as insufficient as we would like to think we are. We have been blessed beyond measure. I'm looking into Pat's right eyes right now, and she knows exactly what I'm talking about. And what price tag did you put on something like that? We know there is no sum of money that is equal to that. But we are to give and to try. To try to embody the extravagance that God asks of all of his people.